We just heard from R. Albert Mohler, who wants Christian evangelicals to proselytize in Iraq. My guest, Charles Kimball, has serious reservations about this work. Kimball is an ordained Baptist minister and is an alumnus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, the seminary headed by Mohler. Kimball is also the author of the book, When Religion Becomes Evil. In the 1980s, he directed the Middle East office of the National Council of Churches. He received his doctorate from Harvard in comparative religion with a specialization in Islamic studies. I asked Kimball to explain his concerns about Christian missionaries going into Iraq.
I have a number of very serious concerns. The impulse to response to try and help people who are in great need, whether it's in war situation or in the context of a natural disaster, is, of course, a central human concern and right at the heart of Christianity. And so that's very normal and indeed highly appropriate. My concern moves at the level of those who are poised to go in with a strong missionary and proselytizing sort of mission as well. I think there are enormous problems with that, and it moves at really a couple of different levels.
What are some of the problems you see with proselytizing in Iraq?
Well, in the first place, this is an area that is living with the history of the Crusades and in the shadow of colonialism. It's an area where people are already very suspicious, as we've seen in the past few weeks and months even, leading up to and during the war itself, where people are very suspicious of what U.S. intentions and U.S. motives are. And to go into an area, especially to tie aid to some kind of proselytizing initiative, would be to fuel the worst sort of fears that this is a new kind of crusade or this really is a kind of Christian imperialism. And I think that is tantamount to a lighted match in a room full of explosives, where we can clearly see every day virtually in the news that comes from Iraq the currents and cross currents and various factions and religious groups jockeying for power and so forth. This is a very precarious situation and one where already people on the other side, especially extremists within Islam, are trying to portray the conflict here and the larger conflict since September 11th, 2001 as a kind of Christian and Muslim war. And so this would feed right into that sort of image. The other thing you have to remember, too, is that many of the groups who've been poised and most visible, like Franklin Graham, Samaritan's Purse, which does a lot of good humanitarian work around the world, the Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Board, or International Mission Board, the largest Protestant denomination, many of the leaders of these organizations have been highly visible and highly vocal for a number of months, talking about Islam as an evil and wicked religion, calling Islam, people within those organizations, people like Jerry Falwell, calling Muhammad a terrorist, and others saying he was a demon-possessed pedophile. These kinds of words, while they may have a short lifespan in the United States in terms of media attention, they continue to reverberate throughout the Muslim world and are on the front pages for weeks and months at a time. And so these people and these organizations are already attached at a popular level in the minds of people, and assistance that comes connected to people who've been making these sort of proclamations is a very volatile dynamic that is sure to cause tremendous problems.
Let's look at a couple of the main missionary groups wanting to work in Iraq. Samaritan's Purse, headed by Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham. What's Franklin Graham's connection to the White House?
Franklin Graham has repeatedly talked about Islam as an evil and wicked religion. Franklin Graham, many Muslims in the Middle East readily point out, is the person who prayed, who gave the invocation at George W. Bush's inauguration. And so he is linked in their mind. And, of course, this past Good Friday, in a highly visible ceremony at the Pentagon, he was the invited featured speaker. So in the minds of people, even though President Bush continually has said, and I appreciate this very much, that the conflict here is not against Islam, that Islam is a good and peaceful religion. He has reiterated that message many, many times since September 11th. Symbolically, this sort of linkage with Franklin Graham is something that many Muslims around the world look at and say words are one thing, but this person continues to call Islam an evil and wicked religion, and so that carries a lot of symbolic power.
Franklin Graham's group is called Samaritan's Purse. What's their track record as missionaries in Islamic countries? What have their priorities been?
They certainly have been at the forefront of humanitarian assistance, very much so in the Sudan. They've been very large presence in the Sudan, where the needs are enormous. And from what I know of their activities on the humanitarian side, they've been enormously helpful. I have no doubts or qualms about their intentions and desire to really help people. And Franklin Graham himself has said on a couple of occasions now that they want to help in Iraq with no strings attached. He's also publicly said a number of times that we will always proclaim the gospel, and the reason that we're there is to share the good news and invite people to join and come to the church. When you combine that with the comments about Islam as a wicked and evil religion, I'm afraid from a practical standpoint that that compromises severely the ability to do the kind of humanitarian work without strings attached. The strings are there. You really only get one chance to make a first impression, and I think in his case, he's made a very strong impression by these repeated comments about Islam as an evil and wicked religion.
The Southern Baptist Convention is one of the large groups hoping to do missionary work in Iraq. What's their track record of missionary work?
The Southern Baptist, of which I used to be a part, I now call myself a Baptist in the South, as do many others, and many of the churches that were formerly Southern Baptist are now independent of the convention. Certainly the mission emphasis all over the world has been a very, very central feature of the Southern Baptist Convention since its beginning in the 19th century, and they have indeed had missionaries working in many parts of the Middle East. In most of the countries, they've been unable to proselytize openly, and so they have engaged in a variety of other kinds of activities. For instance, there was a lot of attention a few months ago to the hospital in Yemen, where there was an attack and three people were killed, three healthcare workers were killed. That's a Southern Baptist missionary activity, one that I think represents the best of what Christian mission can be. In Yemen, it's illegal to proselytize, and the Southern Baptist Hospital has been there for a number of decades, serving the needs of Yemeni people and bearing witness through that. So there, you find a range of things being done. Increasingly, the Southern Baptists are insisting that all of their missionaries spend a large portion of their time in overt proselytizing activities. And this, of course, is where some of the tension comes in a place like the Middle East.
Islam and Christianity both have a history of conversion. What do you think are some of the assumptions underlying conversion?
Well, in the case of these two, it's a very interesting dynamic. Christians and Muslims together make up over 40% of the world's population, and these are two traditions whose histories are very much intertwined. From the Islamic side, it's important to understand the notion of revelation that they understand, the Quran understands, and Muslims have always understood the Christian tradition to be the same religion as Islam, that God has revealed through many prophets and messengers. And if you read the Quran, this includes Abraham and Moses and David and Noah, Jesus, John the Baptist. Jesus is mentioned 93 times by name in the Quran. So Muslims are always a little puzzled that Christians don't simply embrace Islam as the same religion that Jesus brought. Obviously, not many Christians have done that. Some did initially, historically, many did. It seems in the first century or so of Islam, not a lot of Christians didn't really see the difference between Christianity and Islam in major terms and came over into Islam. So to convert to Islam, Muslims wouldn't even probably speak quite in those terms, but rather to re-embrace the same true religion, and you, of course, have to let go then of the divinity of Jesus. In the Christian tradition, which began before Islam as we know it, Jesus is understood as the final revelation and as the one who brings salvation to all. And so Christians have traditionally been puzzled by the idea of a prophet coming after Jesus, and so have tended historically to understand Islam as, by definition, false. There are many of us, and I'm one, today, who believe it's possible to rethink those sort of questions in constructive and positive ways, but that has been a kind of operating assumption throughout most of the centuries of Christian existence.
I'm wondering what you thought of President Bush's use of quotes from the Bible in his speeches leading up to the war in Iraq.
Well, certainly as a historian of religion, someone who studied world religions, it is not unusual at all for political leaders to cite either their personal faith or to cite religious sources as kind of rationale, justification, or empowering, in this case, the struggle of good versus evil. I think the president has used that imagery quite a bit. And he, to his credit, I think, has tried to keep the conflict from being Christians versus Muslims, but he still used religious language very prominently in seeing things in more cosmic terms as a struggle of good versus evil in the larger war on terrorism, and now the brutality and the danger posed by the regime of Saddam Hussein and so forth. So I think on the one hand, it's a very natural thing to do. It's also something that we see repeated throughout history and often abused by religious leaders. One has to always be a little bit wary. Saddam Hussein, back in 1991, and he was a secular thug of the first order. Saddam Hussein got religion in 1991 when he thought it was to his advantage and had God as the greatest sewn on the Iraqi flag, began talking about liberating Jerusalem from the infidels. Anything that could pull at the religious heartstrings of people, he would do. And this, unfortunately and sadly, is a pattern that you see people invoking religion and God being on their side. I don't doubt the sincerity of President Bush. But it's the kind of thing that, as a historian of religion, I'm always a little wary when political leaders resort to or pull religion in as a justification or a rationale or to back up what is happening politically and militarily.
Do you think it's difficult to believe deeply in one religion and also believe deeply in the legitimacy of other religions?
That's a struggle that many of us, I think, have, and those who are honest will wrestle with that. It's certainly something that I've spent a great deal of my life thinking about and wrestling with, how to be a person of faith with depth and integrity and commitment, but at the same time recognize that my experience certainly doesn't exhaust all the possibilities. Indeed, if I'm honest, I'm a different person in some ways than I was 5 years ago, than I was last year, maybe last week. If I'm growing and learning and changing, and some of that involves my religious worldview. When I talk to clergy or do this myself, go back and read your own sermons from 10 years ago, many, if they're honest, will admit it's a fairly painful experience to do that, that your ideas change, that your way of phrasing things or what you've learned in the meantime would help you nuance something in a different way. So I think we have to all be very wary and recognize that we are shaped not only by our experience of religion, but by our cultural context, by the place and time in which we live. I learned this working with the Middle Eastern Christians a great deal, that I often found that I might have more in common with a Muslim in the United States than even a Middle Eastern Christian, even though we're part of the same religion. Just the way I would frame questions or think about issues might have as much to do with the fact that I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1950 in a Protestant family, as opposed to the fact that I was Christian. So there's a lot of interplay between religion and culture, and I think we have to all be very wary of the kind of absolute truth claims that doesn't take these factors into account and our own humanity into account.
You grew up with different religions. Your parents were Christian, but your grandfather, one of your grandfathers, was Jewish. Could you describe how the two religions came to be in your family?
Sure. It's a wonderful, colorful story that too long to, for it would take the whole hour of an interview to tell you. But in a nutshell, my grandfather was one of nine children in a Jewish family that immigrated, was forced out of the Poland-Russia area. They settled in Boston. He actually became a song and dance comedy person in vaudeville. And during the course of his vaudeville days, he met and married my grandmother, who was a Presbyterian chorus girl in the vaudeville show. They eventually settled in Oklahoma. She was from the Missouri-Oklahoma area, but all of his eight siblings married and stayed within Judaism. So my little pocket of the family became Christian. I grew up with a Jewish grandfather in Tulsa, who was the most wonderful person I knew, and my parents really imbued in me and my siblings the notion that to be Jewish was not just okay, it was good. When I began to discover along about third grade that not everyone else in Tulsa shared that same view of Judaism, that really was an important kind of point of beginning to ask that question of what does it mean to be a person of faith, in my case a Christian, but certainly had I been born into any other part of my own family, I would have been Jewish. And what do you do with that? Where is God in that? And that, I think, helps open you up to these wider questions of your own faith and your own tradition, but recognizing that the world, indeed our country, indeed our communities are very religiously diverse. And none of us chose to be born where we were born and to whom and to what family we were born. So that should help us to think more deeply about these questions and be a bit more humble in the way we approach truth claims in the context of religion.
Now, didn't you go through a period when you were young of practicing fundamentalism and believing that your approach to Christianity was the one true way?
Well, I did, and I think a lot of people do, in my own search for truth and understanding. I was very active both within the Southern Baptist Convention and Southern Baptist churches and with Campus Crusade for Christ, a very evangelical Christian group. And in some ways, I developed a deep love for the Bible in that context, and I still cherish that experience. The difference for me, and I think a lot of other people, is that I also learned to ask questions, to think for myself, to think critically, and to keep asking questions and to seeking out truth both within my religious tradition and beyond. Why is it there are 1.3 billion Muslims who for 14 plus centuries have found meaning and been able to guide their lives on the basis of their understanding of religion? I think that's an important question to ask, as opposed to simply saying, well, they're wrong because my experience is right. I find that to be a sort of silly and dangerous way to approach these matters. And so, fortunately, in my own growth and experience with religion, I learned and had good teachers and mentors along the way who helped me learn how to think for myself and ask critical questions and to wrestle with the tensions of what it means to be engaged deeply with one's own tradition, but also open to the fact that my experience does not exhaust the mind of God or all the possibilities.
Was there a turning point in your life when you feel like, this is where I learned to think critically about the Bible? This is where I learned to really believe that there wasn't just one true way?
Well, I think certainly while I was in college, that began to become clear to me because I gobbled up everything I could. I read all the literature. I read all the things, particularly in the most conservative and even fundamentalist circles, that you were supposed to read, and yet I still had questions. Questions like, well, when you look at the book of Genesis, it looks like in the first few two or three chapters you have at least two different creation accounts there. Or if you read the Gospels carefully, you see there are different interpretations or different versions of what happens at the time of the resurrection or even the various stories in the Gospels. And I wanted to know, well, why is that? And I would often begin to find people saying, well, you can't ask that question. God will explain it to us when we get to heaven. I say, well, I am asking the question. I read four Gospels, not one. I'm curious to know why, you know, these are different. I believe it's, you know, part of God's revelation, but I want to know the answer to these questions. And when I began to run into resistance that you can't even ask critical questions, that raised warning flags to me. Something's wrong with this picture. You memorize the system and then you stop. And that, I think, is one of the flaws of all fundamentalist systems in a way, is that there is a kind of closed, codified body of knowledge, and there are certain keepers of that knowledge. And when you challenge them or learn to think for yourself, then you begin to see the system coming apart. They don't want any kind of criticism. You see this with certain you know, very extremist leaders within the Islamic community as well. It's not unique to Christianity by any stretch. You've seen it in a variety of traditions where people know exactly what is true and you're not allowed to think outside the box. That, to me, is a very ultimately an unhealthy form of religion.
You met with the Ayatollah Khomeini after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Why did you get to meet with him, and what did you talk with him about?
This was actually on Christmas Day of 1979, less than two months into the hostage crisis. The quick version of the story is that the Ayatollah had indicated that he would meet with some American clergy, not with any U.S. government representatives. At the time, the Shah was physically in the United States. The Shah of Iran was in the United States, and so tremendous tension between the countries, obviously, with the hostages being held. And so through a series of circumstances, I turned out to be one of the people invited among a number of very prominent religious leaders. I was a 29-year-old doctoral student at Harvard specializing in Islam and Christian-Muslim relations, and so was included in this group. And really, we were the only seven Americans invited to meet the Ayatollah. It was a very warm meeting. He welcomed us, thanked us for coming on Christmas, which he knew was a major sacrifice to leave our families. And it was a remarkable meeting where he welcomed us and encouraged us to go around Iran and learn for ourselves what people were feeling and thinking. And we did do that. And over the course of the 444 days, I was one of two who were invited back on a couple of other occasions to bring letters to the hostages to facilitate communication. And so that meeting with the Ayatollah was very, very important in giving us and me a kind of credibility and a safeness that people wouldn't think that we were CIA agents or something. And so we were able to to move and help facilitate what ultimately became a nonviolent resolution of that very tense situation.
How did you reconcile the fact that the Ayatollah was being very nice to you, very respectful of your religion, but at the same time he was behind holding people hostage and he was in the process of cracking down on Iranians, particularly those who weren't fundamentalist Islamic?
Well, it was a revolutionary situation and a lot of fluidity. There were a lot of groups vying for power and doing things, and certainly I wouldn't absolve the Ayatollah Khomeini of any responsibility in that. I think there were a lot of things happening that got attributed to him because he was the head of the state, but there were many forces at work. He certainly could have had the hostages released. He's the one person who could have ordered that, and it would have happened, and so he did bear responsibility for that. But it's also it's important to put things in some kind of a context. He was also a moral voice of authority over several decades against the Shah and the excesses of the previous regime. He had suffered greatly. His own son was killed by the secret police. And the kind of thing that we look at Iraq today and say, you know, people should organize and rise up against a brutal dictator like Saddam. Well, I wouldn't put the Shah in quite the same category, but there were a lot of excesses in the previous regime in Iran, and he was one of those moral voices of authority. And so, like a lot of leaders, a complex figure, and they're someone who certainly united people and was a uniting force in a revolution. That is, as we know throughout history, a different thing than leading a government. To be a revolutionary leader isn't necessarily the best credentials to be the government leader. And so those were the tensions that were operating. I didn't reconcile all of that. My concern was to try and find ways to move forward and to build bridges of communication to try and help get the hostages out safely and keep Iran and Iraq from going to war, whatever we could do to facilitate that kind of reconciliation in the midst of a lot of chaos and confusion, we hoped would be helpful, and I think it did play a helpful role.
During your travels through the Middle East, did you ever feel that you were distrusted because of a distrust of Christian missionaries? And if so, how did you deal with that?
Personally, not really. There were probably a few occasions where that was the case and I wasn't perceiving it. But I was pretty well known as somebody who had studied Islam, who spoke some Arabic. I often was in the context of Middle Eastern Christian and Christian leaders as well as Muslim leaders. And it was well known that I had been with the Ayatollah, with the Mufti of Syria and the Mufti of Jerusalem and the top religious leaders around in various countries, and was someone that was appreciated. Indeed, the dynamics within these countries is very different than what many people here perceive, because there are Christians who are there in large numbers in Lebanon and in Israel, within the occupied territories, in Syria and Iraq and Egypt and so forth. And so Christianity is not unknown, and indeed people have lived together for centuries. And so connecting with the Middle Eastern Christians and as someone who is a student of Islam, I found always people were very warm and appreciative of that. And so I was not attached to people who might be seen as outsiders who came in with a kind of cultural arrogance, but rather someone who was concerned for the indigenous people, Christians and Muslims, in those places.
Now, you've told us some of your concerns about Christian missionaries going to Iraq where they can evangelize and proselytize. Do you think that there should be any United States guidelines for missionaries going into Iraq now? Or would you like to just see the Christian missionary groups going in on their own decide to not evangelize in a way that would aggressively try to convert Muslims to Christianity?
Well, I think in the best of all possible worlds, we will see societies where people are free to practice their religion, free to proclaim their religion, to invite others to join or invite others to pursue whatever they wish to pursue, that there really is freedom of religion and freedom from religion. But that certainly is not the situation we find in Iraq today. And so I think one has to be very careful and thoughtful about how to move forward. And I believe it is incumbent upon the United States, having toppled the government and having taken on the moral responsibility of facilitating the process to rebuild that society with societal government structures, including economic and political and humanitarian kind of assistance, it's incumbent to have the same kind of collective wisdom and leadership on the humanitarian side as it is on the government building side or the social structure and the government structure side. So I think the United States cannot simply back off and say, well, whatever you want to do, use your best judgment. That would be highly unwise in that kind of volatile situation. And I would encourage that the U.S. government insist that initially the humanitarian assistance come primarily through recognized aid agencies. There are many who have been there during the 12 years of sanctions prior to this war, that those are groups that are known, work through indigenous communities, Christians and Muslim groups themselves, which also makes a lot of sense because it will enable them to find ways to work together and maybe fashion a more hopeful future themselves in the process.
Are you afraid that if Christian groups evangelize in Iraq, that Iraqis will become suspicious of other aid groups, afraid that they too will try to evangelize?
Oh, I think so. I think we have to understand that while most Americans who are not Muslims know very little about Islam and often operate with stereotypes and with distorted and highly misleading sort of images of Islam, the same is true of most Muslims around the world. And so it's very easy for religious extremists or people who have a particular agenda to extrapolate from particular experiences and cast a wide net around other mission and service kinds of enterprises. So you certainly don't want to feed that kind of image. This is one reason why I think it is highly irresponsible for people like Jerry Falwell, who takes to the national airwaves 2 and 3 times a week as a kind of self-appointed leader of Christianity, to talk about Islam as an evil religion and Muhammad as a terrorist. When he does that, he literally puts at risk the lives of Christian missionaries all over the world, not just in the Middle East, so much so that you've even had letters come back and statements from the missionaries. Southern Baptist missionaries have issued statements saying to Falwell and others, knock off this kind of hostile rhetoric. You're making life impossible for us who are trying to work together with Muslims in very difficult situations. So I think that the danger of images and perception being expanded widely and used for nefarious purposes by people who want to paint the most negative picture of Christianity and Christian mission is something we have to be very much aware of.
Is there an example from your own experiences traveling around the world where you feel that you've witnessed a missionary crossing the line into a kind of evangelism that almost became like a cultural imperialism?
Unfortunately, I've seen that a fair bit, especially in the context of Israel and the occupied territories. There are an awful lot of Christian missionaries and parachurch groups who are convinced that the second coming of Christ is just around the corner. They have many of the pieces of the puzzle in place, they think. They have a certain theological view, which is really embraced by millions in the U.S., the kind of view that you see in the Left Behind series, you know, 50 million copies of these books out there, that has a kind of theological framework that sees many of the points of biblical prophecy as they understand it coming in together. And so they want a ringside seat when Jesus comes again and the Battle of Armageddon takes place. And so they're there with a kind of cocksure certainty. Much of what they're proclaiming, of course, looks a lot like American Protestantism and really ignores the indigenous communities. Pat Robertson, who's another major player, used to broadcast on Middle East television and out of southern Lebanon a kind of American view of Christianity and his particular view that Israel could do no wrong and Israel was God's agent. Well, this was going out to Lebanese Christians and Muslims who've lived together for centuries. At that particular time, while Israeli jets were flying bombing missions over southern Lebanon every day with American-made F-16s, that message, I thought, and others too, had an incredibly detrimental effect on the Christians and Muslims themselves in southern Lebanon, who were looking at each other and the Muslims saying, why do you believe this? And they're saying, we don't know who this guy even is. And that's a message that comes in with a kind of cocksure certainty and a kind of imperialism that somehow we in the United States know what is best and our political ideas and our theological ideas are the ones that should dominate. I think people need to be a lot more humble than that and recognize the world can look very different from different points of view, and there are Christians all over the world, Christians themselves, myself included, need to be much more cognizant of how the world looks to other people and even to other Christians around the world. And it's not just an American phenomenon. The church doesn't stop at the borders of the United States.
One last question. You have studied Islamic history as well as Christianity. You're an ordained Baptist minister, but you know a lot about Judaism and Islam. Why follow one religion if you love several?
That's a great question. I have studied deeply in the major religious traditions, including the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, and find a great deal in these traditions that is deeply meaningful and rich and eye-opening and attractive. But I've also found, and I think that some in other traditions might be able to say the same thing that I'm about to say, that when I see something beautiful and deeply meaningful in the teachings of the Buddha, or in the practice of the five pillars of Islam, say fasting during the month of Ramadan or the ritual devotional duties of prayer, when I see something there that is very, very powerful and compelling, what I often find is that same truth or that same teaching is right at the center of my own tradition. I just didn't see it quite that way before. And so my experience of God, my experience of what ultimately matters most, has come through my understanding as a Christian. And in all of my study, I have never encountered things that would lead me personally, some have found this, to want to embrace another religious tradition and leave my own behind. Rather, what I found is that the study of other traditions has helped me to think more critically about aspects of my own tradition and indeed see things within the Christian tradition that are powerful and moving and very much parallel what I found so attractive in another. So some of that may be a givenness of what one grows up with and what where one finds meaning and context in one's own tradition. It's difficult, but some people, of course, do embrace other traditions. That hasn't been the case for me. The study of other religions and appreciation for other religions has really, I think, deepened me as a Christian minister, and as someone who sees the work of the church being part of a ministry of reconciliation and peacemaking among all of God's creation.
Charles Kimball, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it was great to be with you.
Charles Kimball chairs the religion department at Wake Forest University and is the author of the book, When Religion Becomes Evil. Earlier, we heard from R. Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.